You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seats and tray tables are in their upright and locked position. The airlock has been sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. So I feel vaguely redundant, Patrick, like slightly with my whole intro framework there, because, you know, Functional Nerdverse and everything. And I feel like I've either been preempted by, or I have preempted our author with Voidverse as a sort of like, how many other verses are there, do you suppose, Patrick?
Depends on which comic book continuity or television show continuity.
That's a good point. Yeah. Do you have a favorite verse?
Do I have a favorite verse?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, what do you mean?
I don't know. Like,
Star Trek.
For example, here's an example of probably Star not Trek. Your favorite verse. Like,
Star Trek.
Oh, yeah, but there you go. Yeah. That works. Yeah. So, like, the Firefly, they refer to it as the verse or whatnot.
I liked Firefly quite a bit, but it's difficult to separate the artist from the art. That is very true.
And from the apocalyptically terrible decisions made in the film that was meant to bring closure.
I am brown coat, so.
Yeah.
And I'm also a leaf on the wind.
Oh, see, bro. Too soon. It's always too soon. It will always be too soon. At least it's not too soon to talk to Damian Ober. Damian Ober, welcome aboard. Here to talk about Voidverse, which we're running ahead of schedule here because this book is coming out March 10th, yes?
That is correct. Thank you very much for having me. So delighted to be here.
Well, congratulations on the almost book birthday. And this is also a first for you, despite your many writing creds and experiences, because this is your first novel after a career of screenwriting. So unless I have my facts very wrong.
You don't have them very wrong, but you have them a little wrong. I did have a previous novel that was published by a smaller press independently. And then it was published by a U.S. press as well, but it didn't get a big...
That was your Run Silent, Run Dark novel. Yeah,
I was just warming the presses up for that one with that.
Well, congratulations. So, okay. The kind of comparators on Voidverse are intrinsically interesting to me, and I think they're going to make some of our listeners' ears go PC candy and sort of perk up a little bit with the Scooby snacks. I'm thinking of you, Cannoli Joe, here, because it's Dune meets Wool, which is not a set of comparisons that my brain would have mashed together, but clearly you're ahead of the game. So talk concept.
Well, I think, you know, the concept of the book is really the selling point of the setting. You know, it is this sort of theoretically empty infinite void, you know, and everybody lives on these rocks that are falling endlessly through this system. And, you know, you can jump off these things and through like a flying squirrel, like kind of approach, you can create more, you know, resistance and rise up faster than these rocks are sinking down. Or you can, you know, make your body into like a torpedo and go faster and pick up friction as you sink even faster than these rocks. And in this means of travel, these rocks, people go around these rocks and travel, and this sort of trade and stuff pops up, and it sort of takes on the character of like kind of like a feudal Japan almost, or like a Western almost vibe, where you go these vast distances to get to these small little settlements and places. And then as they go further along, you know, each rock has its different cultures and there's different belief systems. And from there you get a pretty classic story. There's, you know, there's the big MacGuffin, this thing that, you know, several different characters want for different reasons, and someone wants the person that wants it. So you get this sort of very high energy, sort of high velocity plot in this really cool, I think really fresh landscape. You know, like I'd come at it as someone who really loved like big worlds as a intaker of sci-fi, you know, as a kid, and whether it was through movies or books or video games, you know, and I really like that idea of creating this like very individual, very specific world that you could, you know, that you could really want to live inside, that would be so exciting and different that you would just kind of want to be there.
I like big worlds and I cannot lie.
Oh, that's a Patrick move right there. You caught me there with the idea of the MacGuffin. And I remember years ago when I was talking to my own agent about elevator pitching and things for my first novel, I used the term MacGuffin to talk about something that was going on with the plot. And she immediately kind of jumped on me. And she was like, I wouldn't encourage you to refer to it as a MacGuffin. And I was like, why is that? And she says, like, well, a MacGuffin suggests that it's not actually important. And it's not that the object itself is sort of arbitrary. And I sort of thought to myself for a moment, and given the position that the particular object I was referring to in my book positioned itself, and I could see why she was anxious about that. And I'm like, but see, here's the thing. I love the term MacGuffin. Because I think that even if the object itself truly has like real importance in capital letters to what's going on in the story world, I love the concept of people are searching for that thing that you can call the MacGuffin, because I think it creates a wonderful vehicle for the thing that matters actually most are the reasons that the people are searching, and therefore the people who are doing the searching. And so, I have a sense that when you're MacGuffining for the void verse, that it's kind of the same thing, that the object itself, while it matters a great deal, is actually a great vehicle for talking about the characters who are seeking it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you really are lining up these different perspectives that are all, I wouldn't even say searching for the same thing. You know, it's like someone's looking for what it means, and someone's chasing it, and someone's chasing the person that's chasing it. And then there's someone who doesn't even know they need it, you know? And how do those stories interconnect, and how can you like bounce like themes off those things that resonate? And like you say, show the differences in the character for like, why are they after it? What is their motivation? And how does their motivation surprise us as the story goes along? You know, how do we find like more humanity in these people through like when we see the reason they're doing it, and it's kind of surprising or touching or sympathetic, even if it's a bad guy, you know?
I know it's like bad manners to ask someone who's working from multiple points of view of multiple characters if they have a favorite, but I'm gonna.
In the book, my favorite character?
I mean, sure.
I love all the characters so much. I have to say that ahead of time, but the main character of The Sinker was just probably my favorite character I've maybe ever come up with in my fiction writing or any writing of mine. You know, I just love her so much. I just think she's cool. There's so much to like, and I like her way she carries herself and the energy she brings into a setting. I think her sort of backstory is really cool and feels like a kind of like something from like a classic Japanese story from some ancient empire, you know, and then she's just kind of like cool and tough and I feel like is the kind of person that you root for, in a way where once they start in the story, you know, that's the person, you know, whether they're not always doing the best thing, like a Mad Max type character. Mm-hmm. You just start to like them so much. And, you know, I just hope that people end up liking her as much as I do. But I do like all the characters a lot, that is to say. You end up spending a lot of time with them as they come into focus through the course of the writing. I also really ended up liking the character who's sort of the engineer on the construct that's chasing them. And he has a pet moth, which I really love. And I always thought it was like so cool that he had a pet moth. And what did that say about him? You know, it's the kind of guy who like runs this giant machine that is like chewing up people's homes and stuff. And yet he goes home and he has his little flakes of dander for whatever you feed a moth, you know, that he puts in his little bowl and the fluttering wings, and it's so cute.
This sort of incredibly delicate creature to be beloved of someone who's got this sort of giant world-eating machine under his direction.
Yeah, it's true. But I think that it is what it is, you know, like it's important for characters to have like the heavy, like thematic things, some traumas and things that we always see at the core of these characters and that motivates them, you know. And The Sinker has a great, great epic motivator at the center of her character. But, you know, it's also great to see like what these people do when they're just like having coffee with their boyfriend or when they're hungover in the morning. And like what, like, you know, I want to see what these people are really like, and I want to feel like, you know, they're allowed to be like kind of very, very real and very like, I want to hang out with them. You know, I want to have a little bit of like of time to have a drink with them or something too, and not just be like always struggling with these, like, with their super deep things, you know, on the surface of the story sometimes. And so those little things like the pet moth to me become really important, you know. And I think for the same reason you say, it's like interesting to think too that you like have this guy who, and he's not like, you know, he's not in charge of this whole place or something, and he's not really like, you know, directly in charge of murdering people, but he is this bureaucrat in this big system, and so he's obviously bearing a lot of the burden. But it's nice to see that at moments you can take a character like that and then you can make, hopefully, the audience or the reader like really like them in some way, you know, or feel sympathy for them in some way, and be able to kind of like feel what it's like to be in their life. And
yeah, Patrick, so I have a question.
So Tracy normally warns people before we start recording that I tend to squirrel. I see, because we have the benefit of video, Uatu standing behind.
Oh yes,
on a shelf.
A watcher.
And I'm curious, because you also mentioned, do you have a machine that is a world eater? Other than your own machine, like, do you have a favorite world eater, like Galactus or Unicron?
I mean, you're going down my list. I love all those things. But it's like the castle from Krall too, you know, that would like around. And definitely, like, you know, Galactus and Silver Surfer was always a favorite storyline of mine as a kid. And obviously, every Star Wars movie has some kind of, like, you know, version of the sort of giant weapon. And it usually is cool. And so, yeah, you know, it's one of those things with these stories. And I think what makes them successful, you know, if you can really, and what I was kind of aiming for is, you know, something that it sometimes feels very familiar, but also so unfamiliar, you know, where you're like, I kind of get it, but like, it's not necessarily Galactus or the Death Star. You know, it's kind of a giant recycling facility, you know, with these like bureaucrats and sorting bins and looking through people's crap and putting them in these different chutes and melting it down and stuff. And like, it's just, you know, like a giant floating factory or something with kind of like a little bit more of like guys scratching their butts and in a union in the bottom floors going through sludge and stuff. And then there's people up on the top who are kind of, you know, and so you're kind of like making your own versions of kind of somewhat familiar things. Same with the sinker, you know, there's the Ronin quality to her that is familiar, but you know, she's a different take on it. And I hope that all the characters are sort of a different take on even your typical sci-fi characters. And yeah, so I think that that's cool to do. And I think one of the reasons why I kind of went with that approach to constructing things is because the atmosphere of it is so stark, you know, the whole physics of the world in which the book takes place, and to call it a world is not really right, but you know, the sort of verse where it takes place, the void verse, you know, to travel from place to place, you basically are like falling, you know, endlessly. You fall, and not, I mean, we've all fallen off a porch maybe or something, or a ladder if we've got unlucky, and you're on the ground before you even know it, you know, it's like, oh, did I even fall? Like, imagine if just falling for like 3 days straight, you know, like you're just continually falling for 3 days straight and like trying to keep your body still so that you can get enough speed to go. And then what does that bring out? You know, what's the survival like? How do you navigate it? What does the map work like? How do you go from place to place and trade and store your stuff?
From a narrative perspective, I imagine it must be kind of tricky to figure out how to approach describing that experience for a character so that you don't end up, There's got to be some amount of existential terror there. There has to be some amount of exhilaration. And there has to be also like the real risk of sort of lapsing into Looney Tunes land of, now we're just going to be sort of falling parallel to one another, you know, chatting while an impossibly long period of time passes. And so I sort of wonder, like, how do you approach describing something that's like so utterly indescribable? Like, what kind of frame of mind do you even have to put yourself into?
That's a really good question. You know, I think it's got two parts to it. One is just the sort of brutal reality of it. You know, you just try to think of like how brutal could I describe it, you know, just to make it so like stark. And like, I remember when I was reading as a younger person in my early 20s and stuff, and I read lots of like books about like exploring places too, you know, like when they would take these like clipper ships into the Antarctic, you know, and they get stuck for 3 years or something, you know, and they move around a little bit. And what that would live in like that, and just thinking about that kind of thing, and what extremity that would be, or like astronauts, you know. And so, you know, you're just like, the sound is just there, and it's like always just like roaring. It's so loud, you have to scream to even hear each other. Mm. And, you know, you're just, your skin is just completely like, you know, you're vibrating so much that it's just, you start to tingle, and like your hands get cold and stuff. And in order to survive, you have to take these little pills and stuff, because you're there for 3 days with just sinking through a void, you know? And then that sort of like would lead into sort of how you would actually render it, which is a little bit more lyrical. You know, you kind of like try to come up with like a vocabulary and a language of its own that it has throughout the book. And you try to set up a way that the sort of sentences move together, and a way that the descriptions are used together. And there's a sort of thematic way that you kind of be consistent with it. And in that, you also are creating the sort of vocabulary of the world itself too. So that hopefully like people can kind of like imagine it in their own way. And, you know, sometimes even using their own vocabulary or things they've imagined while they're reading the book.
You know, you mentioned the clipper ships and, you know, going to Antarctica. Just, I want to say like 2 weeks ago, I guess there's a thing now where you can take a cruise. You could be on a cruise ship that goes into those extreme cold areas.
Oh, wow.
And one got stuck in the ice and could not move. And they had to wait for an icebreaker, I think from like South Korea or something, to come and break them loose and break them free, because they were trapped. Like that still happens now.
See, right now, I'm not sure how much of the fact that I'm suddenly very cold, I can crack up to the fact that I'm literally in the basement of my house right now, be the fact that you're talking about being frozen and trapped for like weeks at a time before like an icebreaker can come get you, or see the fact that Damien has just added like 3 layers of blanket, hat, and other clothing in the course of this discussion. Like, I know you're in Massachusetts, but are you good? Like, do we need to like send a St. Bernard or something with a cask of rum? Are we going to be okay?
I have fire going downstairs, and I didn't really turn the heat on in the rest of the house, so it's not really warm up here. But
oh, okay, you've outrun your own plan. Oh no,
I've had to do that recently because we didn't get snow, but it got bitterly cold. You know, we had I think everybody across the country had that bitter cold, and I didn't want my pipes in the basement to freeze. You know. So actually I have a little gas furnace fireplace thing going, and I had that on during the bitter cold with all the doors and everything open in the basement, just to make sure like,
you know, some of the heat got frozen, circulating,
some heat going through there. Yeah. Fun times. Oh, and then you come upstairs and you're freezing.
It's just, I don't know. I mean, we're spending both the last episode with our guest and this one here with Damien, we've been spending a lot of time talking about sort of like world building and stuff. But now, I don't know. I'm spending
important.
It's super important, and it's one of my favorite things about speculative things. Period. But now with what's been happening weather wise, I'm in the Chicago area, and we had 2 days of school that ended up being canceled because the extreme cold was so great that they could not, in good conscience, have kids waiting at bus stops to be picked up because it was like 20 degrees below zero actual temp, you know, before you even got into wind chill and stuff. And some buses weren't even turning over to begin with. With all of this sort of stuff happening, I've been thinking more about like less world building, but actually like more world destruction. Like how much speculative fiction is the world building that we do to describe the conditions on the ground so that we can then not so much walk it back by having some kind of disaster unfold, but like appreciate the unfolding of disaster as this other vehicle for, I don't know. There's not a question there. It's just a sort of me sitting back going, damn, is really what's happening. But damn. Yeah. And so I do, though, in thinking about the world building here and thinking again about your background having written for the screen before, I have to imagine that if, for instance, someone knocked on your door and said, we would love to buy the rights to do a film or a, you know, a miniseries interpretation of the Voidverse, you'd probably think real hard about that and not just send them packing. But there also had to be a point where you were thinking of this saying, this is a novel here, as opposed to this is a script I'm going to pitch, right? And I'm kind of curious, as someone who has no chops at all in screenwriting, like, how did you know? How did you know this was a novel?
Yeah, it's just too much for a screenplay or a TV show or something. You know, it's just too, I don't know. I also have to say that, you know, like, as a screenwriter, you're not really rendering a final piece of art. You know, you're making an outline for somebody else to make a piece of art from. And once you send off the screenplay, it's like, okay, good luck. You know, you don't have any influence on what's going to happen anymore like that. And, you know, if you really want to make it your own thing, it has to either be directed by you or, you know, it has to be a novel or something, at least for me. I mean, I ultimately kind of like have bounced back and forth between the two. I had actually broken into Hollywood as a writer and first with a novel. Not that the novel didn't like sell or anything, but like it did help me. Like I was like one of the people in town who had a good script and a novel coming out, like, and no one cared if it was going to be good or bad or if it was getting reviews. It just like was something you could say that would make it be like, oh, well, I guess I'll read the one that guy that has the novel coming out. Mm-hmm. And then I immediately just started, I got like a job finally, and just swung from like vine to vine on screenwriting jobs, but would always like tinker with fiction as much as I could. And it was this project as well, most of the tinkering in that time. So, you know, the screenplay idea is, you know, that's something that just feels like a movie, you know, and it has like a beginning and a middle and an end and a three act structure or something. Or if it's just something you think is cool, but like, you know, you can write a script in a few months or something if you're, you know, working full time on it. Or, and I mean, I'm just talking about a draft. I don't mean you fully done, but you know, you can get it out there. You can get it done. But a novel is going to take you several years, and you have to take off all your clothes and leave all your things and go wander into the woods for years. And you know, it's just like a, you know, it's not. Writing a screenplay is a much different thing, and it's. So I would say the commitment to the idea has to be there too. And for me, I wrote a short story back in the early 2000s that was this. It first had come to me as someone's like imagining of a dream that they had in a different story. And I had this dream that was the, you know, that was kind of what this world sort of the rudimentary beginnings of fleshing out the Voidverse world. And I had just been wanting to use it or something. And at first, like, cracked it as the story that someone was telling someone else inside of another story. And so it immediately took on this sort of, like, dreamy, pillow-talky kind of voice of her describing it at night when she would tell, like, oh, yeah, I had another dream about this place. And then I extracted it, and I made it into a short story, and like I said, in the early 2000s or something. And then, you know, I would play with it, and I would expand it, and I had a whole outline in my head about where the plot was going to go. But, you know, I was like, just a struggling writer / bartender for so long. And it was just always a project that was sitting there as I was like failing with other attempts at projects and wrote several novels and it didn't end up going anywhere. But you know, it was fun and I liked it. But this one always stuck there. And I knew I would eventually expand it in fiction. And I knew that it was too much for a movie and that I didn't want to give someone else a chance to do it their way, that, you know, that I had like exactly the vision for it. I knew what it wanted to be. And both in terms of like the world, which is what you would be selling if you just sold as a movie or a TV show, but like the plot itself with the characters and like what's at stake, but also how the characters come across and like what their motivators are and things like that. It's just like, I just wanted it to be like how I wanted it.
Yeah, you'd raised that baby too long to give it up for adoption. It's been there with you for the long haul.
And Tracy, I don't write screenplays. I wrote some scripts for comic books back in the day, but I've never done screenplays. But I can answer your question for you. Once you get to 300, 400, 500 pages, it's not a screenplay.
That's probably true. Yeah.
Because I think isn't it like 100 to 200 is like a 200-page screenplay is like huge.
Yeah, I would say like the average thinking is like a minute a page. So you know, like a 2-hour movie would be 120, and usually it's like you're aiming for somewhere between 120 and 90 pages. I like to deliver a script that is like a lean, mean thing, you know, that's like on the shorter side that someone can read really fast, and not this giant monster that's got like, all, you look at it, it looks like prose, you know, it's like a block.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you got to grab people where they live in that sense. Like if they're looking for something that's going to punch, and they want to grab at it, and they know that they're going to take their liberties with how it manifests anyway. There's a certain point where, yeah, spelling out certain things and really kind of diving deep into them may not be the best investment of your creative energy.
It's kind of fascinating because they've been talking about this for a while, about how streaming and short attention spans are kind of ruining some of this stuff. Sorry. And I know, Damien, we're getting off on a tangent here, but I want to say I just saw a quote, it's not Ben Affleck. What's the other guy's name?
They're Matt Damon. Together.
Matt Damon. Matt yeah. Damon was quoted because he and Ben Affleck just did a thing for Netflix. And he said, you know, the notes from the studio now are just like, you have to be constantly repeating like plot points. You have to repeat things over and over and over again because people aren't paying attention. You know, they're on their phones. And so like if they look up from their phone, you have to be telling them what's happening. And for someone like me who is paying attention, that's fucking annoying. I'm sitting there going, really? You're doing an As You Know Bob right now? Really?
I mean, you need to write for – you're trying to write for the audience that you want, right? And I say this for all types of writing that I can think of. You're ideally writing for the audience that you want, but the reality is capitalism wants the audience to be everybody. Mm-hmm. Like they would really like everyone to show up, please and thank you. And that's where the kind of calculus of how do I tell this story in a way that really serves what I value and what I think the people who I want showing up for it value gets so, so hard.
I think it's tough because there's a lot of like, I can't tell how big the gap is between what people say people want and what people really want. You know,
I think like, it's huge.
Like,
I think it's
people
huge.
Do want this. I mean, I hear it a ton through, like you're saying, either the notes process or the pitching process.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, people want X, Y, and Z. And I just think, and I'm like, really? Is that really what people want? And I look around my town and I'm like, I don't really know. And like, I do think that people are distracted by stuff, but I it's probably always been true. And there's probably always a segment of society that's going to be more short term and into like, you know, whatever you, I don't know how you want to characterize it. And then there's some people who want to, I don't know, some kind of different thing. And I always kind of feel like if you just give somebody like a really good book or a really good show, like,
it can get the job done.
Yeah, that has a cool voice behind it. It doesn't have to check every single box. And it will, especially with so many people absorbing so much stuff. I think you're right. A lot of stuff gets like side railed with that kind of, I would just call it a litmus test thing where it's like, does it do X, Y, and Z along the way at every certain point, you know?
Yeah, they're still trying to figure out appointment TV in the streaming age. And it's really difficult. Like I remember vividly the X-Files. You know, and that being appointment TV. And one of the things that always cracked me up about it is my cousin at the time had gotten divorced and she was dating a new guy. And he glommed onto the fact that I was an X-Files fan and he was an X-Files fan. And this was going to be our connection, right? This is the thing that's going to connect us. And so he would always, you know, call me because this was before texting and stuff. He would call me, you know, after and be like, oh, what'd you think of that? Da, da, da. And then the movie came out that summer, like – the X-Files movie. And he's like, Patrick, we're going to go see the movie. I'm like, yeah, we're going to go see the movie. He's like, okay. And so we go and it's like a group of us and he sits right next to me. And it's very like, it's imperative that he sits next to me. It's like, okay. And the movie starts and something happens on screen. And all of a sudden in my ear, I hear, what do you think that guy's up to?
Oh no. Oh no. And then
do you think that guy knows about the aliens?
Then a half an hour later, he was dead, right?
That's just what he did for the entire movie.
Oh, no.
So the distraction part, you know, that you're talking about has always existed. You know, there's always been the, oh, I know that guy. Where do I know that guy from? That actor. What has he been – like that used to be a game to play in Star Trek. It's like guess the actor under the makeup, you know, Next Generation.
One of my favorite games. Voyager.
Yeah. That's like, oh, I know that voice. That's Golda Kot. He's just in a different makeup this time. you know, stuff like
that. I love when they would bring back a guy like who was maybe a main character on an earlier show, and it's like, oh, he's got a beard, but like that's definitely him, you know.
And then of course you have Jeffrey Combs, who just played everybody.
Oh, he was the best.
Yeah. But I digress, Tracy.
When he comes in and saves Archer with that, and he's like, I thought maybe you could use some help, Pinkskin. I was like so on board right then.
It's funny because old friend of the podcast, Lou Anders, who used to be with Pyre many, many, many moons ago, is just now watching Enterprise. And commenting on it as he goes, and you know, commenting.
Am I Lou Anders? Is me? Am I? Because
no.
Bad at TV, as you know.
No, Lou Anders, and but he was talking about what just a god awful, horrible captain Archer is. Like
that. Oh, yeah.
He's just a terrible captain. He's just reckless. He took his dog on an away mission. He's like, what the fuck? He took his dog on an away mission. You know. Stuff like
was the
that.
Dog in a little red sweater though? Like that's really
no.
kind of
no sweater, but very cute.
Yeah.
No.
Portus. What's that dog's name? Portus.
Porthos.
Porthos.
Is it Porthos? Oh, like Three Musketeers. Name? Got it.
Yeah,
that's right.
Probably. Yeah. Probably and, Three Musketeers reference.
That carried on to another. I can't. Was it Discovery? Discovery. Like someone was talking about getting in trouble because they did something to Admiral Archer's dog.
Oh yeah.
Oh.
I remember hearing that line drop. I can't remember where though.
Yeah, I think it was Discovery. Anyway, sorry, Tracy.
No, it's totally fine. I am thinking back to something you said a couple minutes ago, Damian, about like the gap between what people say audiences want or say audiences expect and the reality of it.
Audiences. I mean, look at all the AI in the world that we don't want that we're getting.
Well, yeah. I mean, any kind of like the gap between the assumption of consumer desire and the reality of what consumers do. Like the discourse right now, not that it's like new, there's been variations on this for decades, but the discourse amongst English teachers right now is that kids not only don't read anymore, but can't read, like actually can't. Like you put a text in front of them and between like their struggle in comprehending things due to maybe vocabulary deficits or whatever else, and also just a lack of attentiveness to the text or ability to kind of like persevere in longer tranches of reading. The kind of discourse has become amongst people in my field, like kids can't read anymore. And that there's no sense of how to like break that pattern. But the crazy thing for me, and this is where we get to that gap thing, is one of the ways that I start the class that I've been teaching in these last couple weeks this semester is by asking students, tell me about your fandoms. Tell me about the things that you're into. And many of them come to me with some anxiety and they're like, does it have to be about reading? Because I don't really read. And I'm like, it's fine. Talk to me about video games. Talk to me about sports. Talk to me about whatever. So they write their things. And I am at the point where 1 out of 5 students whose essays I've graded at this point, and I've graded a lot of these sumbitches, I've got so much grading to do still, but like 1 out of 5 so far are talking to me about web novels. And these web novels average, based on both what these students are telling me and what I followed up on myself to find out, 2 million words. They're written over a course of years in a kind of blog-like structure by these people. And when those are not short chapters either. Like the chapters will have real meat on their bones. I've got students who will talk to me about, you know, like for the last year, I've been reading this 1.5 million word web novel. And it's like, I make sure that I spend at least an hour a day reading it. And some part of me is like, I'm doing the, like the meme thing where it's like the pointing at like, see, it's right here to be like, it's maybe it's that we keep doing this whole people don't have the attention span anymore. You have to repeat the things for the audience. People can't read. People can't X. People can't Y. But we're looking at the wrong things. Like if we keep assuming that the fact that a paperback book doesn't fly off the shelf means that nobody's reading, I submit to you similar concept that kid can find here that apparently is like 880,000 words. And they're just like hoovering it down and looking for the next one. So I don't know. we're bad at something here, but I don't know that it's bad at attending or reading. I think we might be bad at predicting.
No, I think it's more about format.
Yeah.
So you mentioned paperbacks, and that's probably because Damien, I just shared with our patrons an article from the New York Times about how the paperback, the mass market paperback, is going away. Mm-hmm. Right. Because it's being replaced by ebooks mostly. But then there's also the trades now, the trade paperback. And hardcovers are selling. Like hardcovers and trades are selling. Paperbacks are not. And it's a format thing, right? The format is going away. And so it's likely that I don't know the web novels. I don't know, but I'm assuming that the number one, they're free. You don't have to pay anything to read them. So that's probably a plus for them. And like easily consumed on the device that they want to consume it on, right? That's why TikTok is so popular. That's why Instagram is so popular, because it's a format that they want to consume media on. That's where I go. Like, I just think it's about format and being on the platform. I mean, and that's what we've always talked about, right? Forever. Be on the platform, especially as an author. Be on the platform where your readers are.
Yeah, I think about the video games, because I do see like the attention span that's put into a video game. And I don't see how – I mean, I don't mean to say – I mean, I've played video games. I can see how it's different, but I also can see how it's very similar to – your experience with reading a book, where there's a little bit of mental activity, and some of these games, it's like there's a lot of reading. You know, you go interact with the town, and you have to talk to five people in Legend of Zelda and find everything. You know, and there's a mix of action as well in it. And I know that it has a little bit more of a sort of a juice for your endorphins or something, and I guess that plays a part in it as well. But you know, I see kids both sit down and play video games for long times, but I also see, and I don't know the business, so I might be saying something that's not correct here, but I also see how popular all these like young adult and sort of kids series books are, you know, and then they fly off the shelf. And I went to a reading around here somewhere, and it was like hundreds of people at this thing, and they must have sold $1 million worth of books at that event. Sure. You know, and that was kids. It was all kids, you know. It was like their parents had been dragged there by these kids. And I don't see adults going chomping at the bit at a reading. Maybe it would be nice if they were, but like you go to those things and there's some people there and there, but man, the kids were turning out for this stuff.
That's why you have so many science fiction and fantasy authors who are trying to break into those markets and write those kinds of stories. Video games is a great example of what Tracy's talking about, because in the video game industry, you have the corporations saying that what people want are multiplayer action games with microtransactions. And then when you poll players, what do you want? They say, we want a first, you know, one player game. We want a one player game with a story. And so the market is flooded with all these, you know, go online, play with your friends, all these kinds of games. And then, you know, to level up, you got to buy stuff, because that's profitable for them. It's not profitable for them to make a Elder Scrolls Oblivion, right? A single player game with a massive story, and then sell that and give you the whole game. Like, they don't see that as profitable. They don't see that as what people quote unquote want. So you have that push and pull there, where you know they're going, oh no, this is the future of gaming. Everybody wants this. Everybody wants this. And then you have the gamers going, but we don't.
Yeah, I wonder if
Oblivion.
I wonder if the business model will settle and find a way to adapt to that, you know, in terms of the way that you could sell somebody Zelda or whatever it is, you know, Metroid or some other Elder Scrolls, and then you can sell them another, you know, expansion every 6 months or something, and make it a little bit more in that reward. And then you could, like, the way that you can pack on a world to these things now, it's not like a Nintendo cassette where it's like you got the thing and there's no adding anything to this big plastic chunk of thing. You can very easily upload a whole new world, do a Metroid or something or Zelda, and just have it expand and just keep people buying. And you're, I don't know, I mean, not to sound like I want to make tons of money off people, but like you could see how they could make money that way and still deliver what it seems like people want.
That's what keeps Blizzard alive with World of Warcraft. Like, World of Warcraft reinvents itself every couple of years with something new. But also there's the idea of seasons of a game, You get a season pass to the game, and the season is a whole new bulk of content. And then the next season comes and there's a whole new bulk of content. So there is like people playing with what you're talking about in that concept and the DLCs and stuff. But you also have old people like me who remember buying Zelda and buying, you know, Dragon Warrior and Final Fantasy and all these games. And you would buy the game and then you would play the game. You didn't have to go online to play the game. You didn't have to go online to get a DLC to play the game.
Oh, silly man. We don't own things anymore. We just license them. Yes.
That's part of the problem that you have. Anyway. Yes.
Well, this is probably a good time to turn towards something that feels more concretely good. So picks of the week?
Picks of the week.
The week.
By your command.
Welcome to February. How's it going? You enjoying it so far? Yeah. Good. Oh, by the way, we'll get to picks of the week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, they say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes, like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere, but you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month, and that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month, and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever, our brand new and popular so far, I'm enjoying it, a lot of other people are enjoying it, but our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us. And we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on. What are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
Patrick, you got a pick?
I do. And I'm reaching over here because I'm gonna do a video and do a great video thing for our audio podcast.
Good. So, perfect.
As listeners know, I am a game master. I run Pathfinder. Today is Pathfinder Saturday for me, so I will be running Pathfinder later on today. And one of the series of books that have been enjoying that is kind of agnostic and can be used across different systems is the Game Master's Book of. And I already have and have used the Game Master's Book of Traps, Puzzles, and Dungeons. And I recently picked up the Game Master's Book of Instant Towns and Cities. Oh. And the concept here is pretty easy. You can, if you need suddenly like you, you, you don't want to build your entire city or you don't want to build your entire town, you can just flip to a page and like, here is all the stats and everything and the history and everything you need to know about a city called Stonehaven. And boom, you've got your instant city right here. You don't have to do a bunch of pre-game setup to create your city. You can basically grab one from the book and drop it into your campaign. It's very similar to the idea of OSR games, which I also love, and I do use a lot of books of random tables,
yeah,
where you can very quickly just like roll up like names of books in a library, you know, or items in a tavern, or things they find in a secret hidey hole. Yeah. You know, I have stuff like that too that I use in my games. But this is something that, you know, if you just suddenly like you're like, okay, they're going to in this session, I know they're going to come across a town. I don't want to build a whole town. Boom, you go to this book. You've got yourself a town.
Nice.
And I love that kind of stuff. It's a nice little shortcut. Again, system agnostic. This is, you know, they say it's compatible with your favorite fantasy tabletop RPGs. But specifically, like they do have stuff in here for 5th edition. But you can very easily port it over to Pathfinder or Shadow Dark or something else if you're playing. Nice. And there's a bunch of people who wrote this and who contributed to this. It's not just one writer or one artist, but like illustrated by Luke Eidenschink and Matthias Graf. And then there's just like a bunch of people who have written and put stuff in here. And there's a foreword by Bob World Builder. And if you're familiar with his YouTube channel, he's a lot of fun. So
nice.
That's my pick this week.
Very cool. Very handy.
Yeah.
So Damian, how about you?
Yeah. You know, we already touched on Star Trek a little bit. And I thought since this is a nerdy show by title, I would kind of double nerd it up here. And I was going to talk about a board game that I really liked that I just recently played again for the 100th time or something, called Star Trek Ascendancy. Which is like, if anyone's a fan of like the Twilight Imperium style, space politics, resource management, and game, you know, Twilight Imperium is the masterpiece. But like, if you like Star Trek and you like that kind of game, and you have to probably sit down and play it a few times, you know, it'll take a few sittings to finish it. But it's great, and it just does all the things with like the resource management and the alliances, and the combat's simple enough and it's fun. But you also have lots of Star Trek. Like every time you find some planet, you flip over a card and it's from some episode, and it's kind of funny, and there's some factor of it. And more than any of these other games, like you really have to lean into the race that you end up being. Like the Klingons, if you're the Klingons, you just have to fight with people. If you're the Kardashians, you have to invade people's planets, and they all have this different way you win the game, and the Ferengis have tried to make the money, and the Vulcans have this mysterious way that they're trying to win. So I have played it a lot, but I really recently played again for the first time in a while with some friends, and it was fun. It's great. So I highly recommend that. If you're a fan of big board games and Star Trek, it's a great combo.
Nice.
Yeah. Black and Red, which is a used book and game store, music store here in the greater Denver metro area, never has that in stock, because I have asked multiple.
You gotta just order it.
Multiple times I have asked.
Multiple times. So this one is not a big board game. This is a tiny little board game. And in fact, it's hit the table several times in Shea Townsend as a after dinner, before we kind of go our separate ways to do things for the night game. It is there's kind of a revolution right now in tabletop gaming for small box games. Definitely, you know, the Star Trek Ascendancy is a big box game. TI is absolutely a big box game. Small box games, as you'd guess, is the opposite concept. Like, let's have the minimum number of components. Let's make this something that you can like toss in a purse or a backpack, and it can just kind of go with you. And one of the best small box games I've played in a while is Sea Salt and Paper. Which, as a name for the game, I didn't really understand what was going on with it until I opened it up and saw the art. So one of the most charming things about Sea Salt and Paper as a game is that the art itself is all origami style. And so all of the art assets on the cards are actually origami imagery. And as you'd guess from the rest of the title, the sea salt part, it's all maritime themed. And so you've got, you know, different types of interesting fish and crabs and so on and so on. It's a set collection game. But as a set collection game, it has some interesting novel mechanics that help generate, in addition to the fact that it's got this really cool art, kind of interesting synergies and things. So if you get certain pairs that you play at certain times, it allows you to take an extra turn or to raid the discard pile and so on and so on. But what's really interesting about it is how you end the game. So whoever wins the game wins only by having 35 or more points accumulated. And there's a way at the end of a turn that you calculate your points based on the cards that you've got. All that makes sense. But the way you end a hand that accumulates towards ultimately possibly winning that game is as soon as you've got at least 7 points on your tableau, you can call to end the round. And you can choose to call to end the round in one of two ways, either just by saying stop, in which case no one else gets a turn after you, the round's over, everybody reveals what they've got, and we count out the points. And that's a good one to do if you're not sure if other people have more points than you or not, and you just kind of want to kill things before anybody else gets on a real good roll. The other option is to say last chance. If you say last chance, the move that you're making is not only saying I'm stopping the round, but everybody else gets one more turn. And that's important because if at the end of the calculation of points, you still have more points than everyone else, not tied, but more points than everyone else, you get these additional bonuses to your score. If, however, you gambled wrong in how you were card counting for other people and you were way off and someone beats you, then you only get to count what's called a color bonus on your cards, which is practically nothing at all. And that person ends up getting this big bonus. So there's kind of a push your luck element to it that gives it this additional dimension. It's super easy to learn. It plays very fast, generally about a half an hour. And it takes anywhere from 2 to 4 players. So if you're looking for a tidy, tiny little game that anybody, the way Little Deirdre would have said it, is 8 or plus, could enjoy, Sea Salt and Paper is a really solid buy.
Very cool. And Damien, I will throw it out there that Star Trek Lower Decks has a pretty cool game.
Oh, yeah? I like that show a lot. I didn't know there was a game.
Yep, it's called Buffer Time.
Okay.
If you're familiar with the episode of Buffer Time.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah?
I am. My son and I watched that show and really liked it, so I'm looking forward to get that game for him.
That's one of my favorites.
All right. So we've been on quite a journey through Voidverse and, you know, beyond to many other places here. Damien, where can people find you and support your work and other cool stuff?
So you can just go and order Voidverse from your local bookstore or from wherever you buy a book. By the time this podcast comes out, it'll be basically out. You know, it'll be out in a week or two after this comes out. And if you order it right now as you're listening to this, it'll come just like it's out. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do a couple readings. There's one in New York, if you're in New York, on the day that it comes out, which is the 13th, 10th, March 10th. And then there's one in Boston, March 13th, if you want to actually come out and get a book signed or something or have a question or whatnot. But if you liked anything you heard, I would say just go buy the book. That's the best way to support me.
Fantastic. And by March 10th, it may even have stopped snowing.
Yeah, I wouldn't count on it, but we'll see. I still have a few feet outside here.
So when you get to Boston, are you going to get chowder?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Which kind?
The
there's
Boston
more than one kind.
Two kinds. There's the creamy, and then there's the other one.
There's the one you pour down the drain, and then there's the one you eat.
Yeah, so if you have chowder that has tomatoes in it or corn, that's not chowder, right? That's your drain chowder you're talking about, right?
That is definitely drain chowder. All right, well, Damien, chowder heresies aside, we hope that you have an excellent time in Boston eating the only real chowder, which in fact has no tomato products in it. And good luck with your debut.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the dash functional-nerds on Facebook, at functional_nerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY.social. I know. I couldn't keep it copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching. If you want me, it's ATFMB, because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on, and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent. So you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know? It does help. Thanks again for listening. And I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet? Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry. Do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.